Good morning. I want to draw your attention to the order of service. The beautiful drawing designed by Vivian Martin. Vivian called me up to talk about something, and I was thinking about this sermon, and I told her about the story, and she went and looked it up and read it, and then she drew this magnificent drawing that I think captures the energy of the story so well. I think you'll understand when you hear the story told. And especially, I think that red spot will stay in your memory, which Vivian applied to every single order of service by hand. We do not yet have a printer that will do that. Not to my knowledge. Well, this story that I'll be telling is from India's Mahabharata. That's the longest epic poem in the world, 10 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. Imagine being in a high school class in India. It's a cluster of many stories fit into the overarching narrative of a great civil war between two branches of the same clan, a war that goes on for years but achieves very little good. Today's particular story takes place many years before the Civil War begins. Takes us to the elite academy of military tactics and martial arts, headed by the renowned Dronacharya, or Professor Drona, who is said to be invincible as long as he kept his weapons raised. Elite leaders of what will later become the opposing sides in the war, the Kurus and the Pandavas, are studying together as friends, just as many generals from both sides in our own civil war had done at West Point. Prince Arjuna is by far the favorite elite pupil of their very elite teacher. Drona began to teach Arjuna the art of fighting on horseback, on the back of elephants, on chariot, and on the ground. And the mighty Drona also instructed Arjuna in fighting with the mace, the sword, the lance, the spear, and the dart. And he also instructed him in using many weapons and fighting with many men at the same time. Now at this same time, there lived near the school a young man named Eklavya, whose heart burned to learn from Drona how to master the bow and arrow. Drona watched the lad demonstrate what he'd learned on his own and saw that he had great potential. But it was sort of like an admissions interview. But Eklavya was dark-skinned and from a very low-caste community called the Nishada. The great master had no desire to see such a one surpass his high-born students in skill. So the story tells us that Drona, cognizant of all rules of morality, please remember those words, refused to teach him. And so Eklavya, quote, touching Drona's feet with bent head, wended his way into the forest. And there he made a clay image of Drona and began to worship it respectfully, as if it were his real teacher, and practiced weapons before it with the most rigid regularity. In consequence of his exceptional reverence for his teacher and his devotion to his purpose, all the three processes of fixing arrows on the bowstring, aiming, and letting off became very easy for him. Eklavya has created a virtual teacher to help him when a real teacher refused. We'll see how that works out for him when we continue with the story. But first, let's sing hymn number 305, De Colores. Number three. Thank you. Eventually, we're just going to absorb each other's languages from each other. It's kind of like a natural Rosetta Stone. The more we share food and restaurants and the streets and festivals, that's just going to happen. Let me continue that story. One day, the Kuru and Pandava princes, right, the princes from what will be the other sides in the civil war, set out in their chariots on a hunting excursion, followed by a servant and a dog. Having come to the woods, they wandered about intent on hunting. Meanwhile, the dog wandered off and came upon Eklavya, and beholding the Nishada of dark hue, of body besmeared with filth, dressed in black and bearing matted locks on his head, the dog began to bark aloud. Well, Nishada seems to have been the N-word of this particular place and time. You may have heard of dogs that either by deliberate training or just by picking up on their owner's body language, bristle and bark when encountering members of minority communities wearing dreadlocks or whatever. I wonder if that's what's up here. Well, we read next that Eclavia, desiring to exhibit his lightness of hand, sent 7 arrows into the dog's mouth, effectively stitching it shut. When it came back to the Pandavas, they were filled with wonder and ashamed of their own skill and began to praise the lightness of hand and precision of aim exhibited by the unknown archer, and began to search the woods for this expert. They soon found him, ceaselessly discharging arrows from the bow. They asked the stranger, "Who art thou, and whose son?" The man replied, "Ye heroes, I am the son of the leader of the Nishadas. Know me also as a pupil of Professor Drona himself." The princes then returned to the school and told Drona of that wonderful feat of archery which they'd witnessed in the woods. Arjuna, in particular, was thinking all the while, "Eclavia, Eclavia." He went to see Drona in private and complained, "Thou hadst lovingly told me, clasping me to thy bosom, that no pupil of yours should be equal to me. Why did you teach that son of a Nishada to be better than me? Oh, Eclavia, Eclavia, Eclavia!" Whatever you think of Arjuna's attitude, at least he's honest enough to come right out with it. "Teacher, how could you let this happen? That my social and racial inferior should become superior to me in anything." It wasn't all that long ago that there were no professional black athletes. And later, in football, no black quarterbacks, because they just didn't have what it takes to lead on the field. I've heard the great tennis star player Serena Williams speak with patience and pain how some sports writers will talk up her muscular serves but never credit her tactical intelligence, focusing on her strong black body and not much more. It's as if there's something not quite right, not altogether decent about a black woman being so very good at what she does, like it breaks some kind of rule of morality. How do those writers sleep at night? Remember how Drona refused to help Eclavia cultivate his abilities in part because the great master was so cognizant of all rules of morality. What's the idea of moral behavior here? We'll see. Now he takes Arjuna, that princely teacher's pet, along with him to get to the bottom of the mystery of this dark-skinned archer. They go to the forest and find Eclavia and saw his body besmeared with filth, matted hair, clad in rags, bearing a bow in hand and ceaselessly shooting arrows. When Eclavia saw Drona approaching him, he came forward, touched his feet, and prostrated himself on the ground. You have to see this to believe it. This will happen in India with teachers. And the young Nishada, worshipping Drona, duly presented himself as his pupil, and clasping his hands in reverence, stood before him, awaiting his commands. Reverence for teachers, especially teachers of religion or of the arts, runs very deep in India, and accepting certain burdens and inconveniences has always been part of it. When I began studying classical Indian vocal music with a teacher in California in the early 1970s, I found myself doing things like cleaning his oven late in the evening, or walking his daughter to school early in the morning. On stage, I was responsible for providing him with a cup of hot Ovaltine when he gave me the Ovaltine glance, which meant all the while I had to continue playing a simple instrument, get this thing open, and get the thing poured, and you know, it's very entertaining, I'm sure, for the audience. A few years later, when I traveled to India to continue my studies, he asked me to accompany him on a concert tour to some cities in the south. We took an overnight train, an Indian train, which just like looked just like the locomotives in old Wild West movies. They were still coal-fired, with huge smokestacks billowing clouds of black smoke that, depending on wind conditions, either mostly rose above or mostly blew into the second and third class cars. My teacher was riding in an air-conditioned first class compartment. I was riding third class, which meant sitting on a bare wooden plank in the smoke and the breeze from the unglazed windows, and then sleeping on that same plank, or one above it. The passengers had to unfold them themselves. And spending the night that way while goats and such would sleep on the floor. Now, seasoned local travelers bring their own bedding, but I didn't know that drill. No matter, I can sleep pretty well on pretty hard surfaces most of the time. I was just drifting off when I heard my teacher's voice calling my name, which he always spoke as one word. Craig Morrow? Craig Morrow? Yes, what's wrong? Craig Morrow, I need you to keep Tambura with you. Thieves come into first class, but they leave third class alone. I'm not going to do the accent the whole time. The tambura is a long-stringed instrument without frets that's played with one hand to provide a drone for singers or for other instruments. It's almost 5 feet long and has a big bulgy belly that can be over a foot deep. The sleeping planks were made for the average Indian of the time who was perhaps 5 feet two to four. I stood a towering 5 foot six. At that time. So, of course, I said yes. That's the kind of thing a teacher in India might ask you to do. Before the concerts, I slipped with this thing with me on the plank. And before the concerts started, we made a quick side visit to my teacher's hometown so he could pay respects to one of his teachers. This guy was a rotund man who was wearing no shirt, as is the custom in that part of India. When we entered his house, my own teacher suddenly disappeared. He had prostrated himself full length on the floor. The old man then saw my eyes widen and pointed to his chest and asked me, "Are you shocked by this bare body? Are you shocked by this bare body?" No, but I hadn't expected anything like this floor show by a man who is now himself revered as one of the great performers of our time, my teacher. I wondered what further things my teacher might now expect of me. I got my answer on the return trip. My teacher's daughter had begged him to bring back a kind of giant banana that's called Nyandarparam that only grows in the region we'd been visiting. The skin and flesh are orange. They're very high in protein, delicious too. Each one is about 16 inches long, and a large bunch of them would half fill the trunk of most cars. On the train back to my teacher's city, I had just bedded down on my plank with the tambura lovingly braced between me and the wall for safety when I heard my teacher's voice again. Craig Morrow? Craig Morrow, my daughter would cry if someone stole her Nyandarparam before we got home. Please keep them with you. Well, what could I say? I put the giant bunch of giant bananas where my feet and legs should have been. I'd heard stories about my teacher and the extraordinary things his teacher used to ask him to do, not just dropping to the floor, but dropping whatever he was doing and leaving his family in order to rush and perform a concert in his teacher's place because the old man had gotten a better offer, higher paying. Nobody ever tells you what service an Indian teacher might expect of you. But at least they're pretty upfront about the cost of tuition. Which brings us back to the story of Drona and Eklavya. When Eklavya saw Drona approaching, he came forward, touched his feet, and prostrated himself on the ground. And the young Nishada, worshipping Drona, duly represented himself as his pupil and, clasping his hands in reverence, stood before him, awaiting his commands. Then Drona addressed Eklavya, saying, "If, O hero, thou art really my pupil, then give me my tuition fees." Hearing these words, Eklavya was delighted and said, "O illustrious teacher, what shall I give? Command me, for there is nothing that I may refuse to give to my teacher." Eklavya is delighted when Drona demands his tuition fees, thinking if he wants to be paid, then that means he's accepted me as a student. Acceptance seems to be almost within the reach of Eclavius' fingertips. Now please hold on to yours. Trona said, "Oh, Eclavia, if you are really intent on making me a gift, I should like to have the thumb of your right hand." What would you do if someone made a request like this of you? It would be as if my singing teacher had asked me for my tongue. In a real student relationship, a bond grows between people who care about each other as human beings, whatever the subject or art that's being taught. But our story is telling us about the relationship of a real student with a virtual teacher. We may see Eclavia as a brilliant autodidacta, self-teaching student, but he doesn't see himself that way. The Drona of his mind has been his guiding light, allowing him to learn things he might never have grasped if he just said to myself, "I'll pick up the bow and arrow and master them on my own." The real Drona cares nothing for this stranger. He senses the real power that Eclavia has invested in the virtual Drona and in the conventions of student and teacher. He handles this power as effectively as any weapon. So Eclavia, ever devoted to the truth and keeping to his promise, with a cheerful face and an unafflicted heart, cut off his thumb and gave it to Drona. Are you shocked by the naked cruelty of this story? It would be very different if Drona had hidden some other students in the woods so they could jump out suddenly to grab Eclavia and hold him while maybe Arjuna cut off his thumb. That would be a totally different story, and one with much less power. It would be a matter of strength and not of power at all. The real violence of power like this is how it hustles us into violence against ourselves. And we're so confused that we comply. Eclavia responds too quickly, hoping to prove his faith and devotion. At first, he hardly seems to know what's happened. When the young Nishada began once more to shoot with the help of his remaining fingers, he found that he had lost his former lightness of hand. And at this, Arjuna became happy, the fever of jealousy having left him. After this, we'll hear no more of Eclavia. What kind of friend, husband, father, teacher, citizen will he become? What sort of story might he tell his children about these events? And how will that shape them? We don't know, because the epic cuts him out from this point on. The stories of Drona and Arjuna and Drona's other students will continue from this bloody red point forward. Later, they'll be joined by the blue god Krishna, and the story will branch off again into the famous Bhagavad Gita, which Gandhi loved so much, which has attained the status of a religious scripture for millions of people in India and beyond. But let's not put this tale behind us too quickly before we listen to its last words again. Eclavia had lost his former lightness of hand, and at this, Arjuna became happy, the fever of jealousy having left him. Arjuna, born into the elite, had been experiencing symptoms because a man he saw as his social, racial inferior was getting ahead of him. The thought has been crowding his sleeping space worse than a bunch of giant bananas. Eclavia! Eclavia! We can imagine him waking in the middle of the night thinking, "There's a black guy where he shouldn't be. There's a black guy where he shouldn't be." Same thing in the morning. His first thoughts, "There's a black guy where he shouldn't be. There's a black guy right where I should be, or someone who looks just like me. What's next? If one of them can pull ahead of me just because he's twice as good at something, will they get ahead of us?" But now things feel better. Eklavya loses his thumb and his lightness of hand, while Arjuna regains his lightness of heart. Mutilation for one becomes healing for another. Arjuna has learned an important lesson from Drona, even more important than all of that instruction in the art of fighting on horseback, on the back of elephants, with the mace, the sword, the spear, and with many men at once. He has learned to fight his own conscience and to win. He'll learn to apply this lesson again and again in the civil war to come. Arjuna, Drona, and Eklavya were probably not real people. Abraham, Moses, even Jesus might not have been either, but they still teach many, many students. A great deal of what we call religion involves finding or fashioning virtual teachers like Eklavya did with Drona. Often the results are better, but we know they can be worse. Religious scriptures and the religious history of the world is punctuated with many, many red points, red pages, and even whole red chapters. When virtual teachers or real ones push us to grow, even by making us uncomfortable at times, that's to be expected. I learned something by sleeping with my teacher's baggage cutting off my legroom, something about asking almost too much, but not quite. Those seven principles that appear every week on the back of your order of service sometimes seem to ask too much of me, but that's probably when they do me the most good. Encouragement to growth is what it's all about, and a free and responsible search for truth and meaning and respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person, even when that's not easy. But it's important to be selective when choosing teachers, virtual or real. Cutting off legroom is one thing. Cutting off a thumb is quite another. Anthropologists ponder the interplay between the human brain and the human hand with its opposable thumb, how they might have shaped each other, and how the two make us human. Cutting off a person's thumb is an attack on their humanity. Participating in such an attack cuts something off from ours. It wasn't so much Eklavya's skill that upset Drona and got Arjuna to go around muttering, "Eklavya, Eklavya." It wasn't all the wonderful things that he could do as an archer. The problem for them was with who he was. Anishada, the N-word of their day, crowding a niche they thought was all their own. Best to nip that in the bud. I hardly need to tell you that this story is far from over. Pick up a newspaper any day and you'll read another variation from another part of the world, east, west, north, and south. Sometimes the story is about complexion, sometimes it's language, sometimes it's religion, though everybody looks and talks the same. Sometimes the differences that mean so much to us seem to be almost entirely virtual, although the flesh and the blood and the pain are all real. The Mahabharata is a very ancient work, 10 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. It's filled with many virtual teachers, many virtual students, all trying to learn what it means to be a whole human being. How much is brain? How much is thumb? How much is action? How much is heart? Like the best teachers do, this virtual teacher gives us plenty of material to work with before leaving us to answer these questions for ourselves. Like any great epic, it tells many stories, more than we'll ever have time to hear together. Thanks for letting me share this one with you. Blessed be.